History happened everywhere. A random place, a random time, and a topic pulled from the hat. The challenge? We don't do this anymore, do we?
No, we don't, but it's fun hearing it. Haven't heard that for a while.
And share the stories, why not? You're listening to...
History happened everywhere.
Hello, my name is Pete Goddard and I'm here in the HHT studio with the Boudicca to my Roman Empire. It's Mr. Ryan Weir.
That's right. You better watch out, sir.
You are the pesky, rebellious pain in my bottom.
I will burn this city to the ground.
So last week, the Derslator gave us, for episode 91, Bigger Than an Elephant, in London during 509 to 27 BCE, aka the Roman Republic. Plus, we are under instructions from the judge to do this episode together. So Ryan, what have we got in store for the listeners today?
In this week's episode, we are staying close to home to look for things that are bigger than an elephant during the time of the Roman Republic. That's right, we're dialing back Big Ben's clock to a time before cockneys and monarchs, when Iron Age chieftains ruled forest-lined banks of the River Thames. We're going to take the tube to Knowledge Junction to visit the Iron Age camp where ancient forefathers turned horns and bones into an effective box of tools. We'll take a double-decker to Downing Street to meet the terrified prince whose makeshift vessel turned the tide for a determined Italian. And we're going to head to Piccadilly Circus to find out why trunks in London shouldn't be filled with booze. Welcome to the Swinging City! Welcome to the Big Smoke! Welcome to London!
Hooray!
The Thames is shorter than the Seine. London Bridge is longer than a plane. The London Eye is taller than Big Ben. And London is bigger than Berlin.
Well, Ryan, this feels like an odd question to ask, but can you orient us? Where is London?
Ah, London, the capital city of England and the United Kingdom. Located in the southeastern part of England, you're going to find it sitting astride the River Thames and wrapped lovingly within the 117-mile circle of the M25 motorway.
Famously busy and traffic-logged, for those who are not aware of the M25.
And at time of present, partly closed. Essentially, it's a large collection of villages built on top of a floodplain and surrounded by gently rolling hills. It's split into two main areas, London, which refers to the larger metropolitan area, and the City of London, which is a tiny area, it's just roughly 1 square mile, 3 square kilometres, that forms the main financial district and has its own little local authority. But anyway, together they make a city that is home to nearly 9 million people, all crammed into an area that covers roughly 1,572 square kilometres, which is about 160 Londons to a France.
Ah, yes. Well, that's not surprising, is it?
No, not really. It is considered one of the most multicultural cities in the world. Virtually every nationality is represented here, with over 300 languages spoken, reflecting various people from around the globe. So think of London, Pete. Various images are going to pop into your mind. You got landmarks like Houses of Parliament, Big Ben, Buckingham Palace, the London Eye, the Tate Modern, the Tower of London, Tower Bridge, St. Paul's Cathedral, Hyde Park, Oxford Street, the BT Tower, Canary Wharf, the Shard, the Gherkin, the Walkie Talkie, Camden Bridge, Platform 9 and 3 quarters at King's Cross Station, and of course that famous monument.
Yes, that's always a confusing one for the cab driver, isn't it? Take me to the monument.
Now, London doesn't have an official animal, Pete. British cities do have them, like Manchester's has the bee, Birmingham has the bull, but London doesn't have one. But if it were to have one, you'd probably think of the raven, considered to be the guardians of the Tower of London, and by extension, therefore, the city itself. In fact, there is a superstition, Pete, that if all the ravens are lost or fly away, the crown will fall.
I bet they've got a vet on hand at all times.
Just a big net over the top.
Yes, they are tethered, as I recall.
Are they? Right?
No, they're not.
All right, alternatively, Pete, I was thinking you might pick a fox or a pigeon, because they're pretty much everywhere in London.
I would pick a fox, because I get foxes in my garden, and this is London.
Yeah, you've also got squirrels as well.
I have squirrels, but they're in my house, which is much worse.
Now, London doesn't have an official song either, you know, like an anthem, but if we're looking for a piece of music that does capture the energy of the city, then we could probably do no better than London Suite by composer Eric Coates. And it sounds, Pete, a little something like this.
Oh yeah, London, streets, adventure.
Imagine, Pete, us sitting on an underground train, whipping our way through London. This song, London Suite, is composed in 1933, said to be a musical painting of London. It captures the essence and the vibrancy of the city through sound.
I feel like I'm on a jolly commute, but as portrayed in the 1950s, not the crammed, horrible hellhole of a modern commute.
Indeed. The suite covers four movements in total, each depicting a different aspect of London: Covent Garden, Westminster, Knightsbridge, and London Bridge. It's said that Coates' method for composing this was basically visiting each of those four areas, absorbing the atmosphere, and then translating that into music.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I look forward to a modern composer doing that for the Croydon area. Opens with a siren, I don't know where you take it from there.
It was used as a theme for BBC Radio's In Town Tonight, and that was what really made the suite famous with the public.
Well, I, for one, like it very much. I think you've done well to sort that.
In London facts!
This could be your most specific types of facts yet.
Well, normally we have, like, you know, facts about the place, but I thought, well, why not? Let's go deeper.
Deeper.
Let's find elephants
way
in London
deeper.
Facts.
I'm excited to hear what you come up with. I have one in the top of my head, so let's see if you can get that one.
If I had to guess, it's probably elephant and castle, right? Because we probably need to talk about that.
We should.
It's the elephant in the room. Okay, so for those people that are unaware, there is an area of the city with a rather unusual name, Elephant and Castle. It's a name that originates from a coaching inn that stood there in 1765. It had a sign outside with an elephant carrying a castle on its back. Now, some people think that the name comes from the London accent saying Infanta de Castile, which is a title that's held by a Spanish princess. But the truth seems to be that it actually relates to a medieval trade guild called the Worshipful Company of Cutlers. These were a group of people that made swords and knives, specifically with ivory handles. So the story goes that the elephant's tusks symbolise the blades, and the castle apparently just shows the sheer size of an elephant, which I don't know why they didn't just show the elephant.
I would have said they're famously large, aren't they?
Yeah.
For the audience, Elephant and Castle is actually quite nice now, but when I was a youth, it was a rough old place.
It sure was. Now, the first recorded elephant in London, Pete, was in 1250. Which is a lot further ago than I thought it would be.
Yeah, that's really early.
This was when the King of France gifted King Henry III of England one.
Yeah, I'm always giving elephants away. It's quite commonplace, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, it's said that Henry housed it in the Tower of London before moving it to a special elephant house. But unfortunately, it didn't live there very long because apparently no one knew what or how to feed it. So it died pretty quickly.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah. Tusk, tusk.
Oh, dear.
Come on.
No.
Now, also in the 19th century, Pete, a celebrity elephant got drunk and killed a bunch of people.
We've all done it.
So during this time, elephants were used in various shows in London theatres. Now, for convenience, their stables were located near those theatres, specifically the Theatre Royal in Haymarket. Now, people who saw the shows would then go and see the elephants, and sometimes they would give them a drink of beer. Well, on one occasion, a group of people all turned up with beers, got the elephant so drunk that it broke free and trampled several people to death.
Fun fact!
And finally, during World War II, elephants were made to work in London. And that was because when the city was being bombed every night during the Blitz, elephants from the circus were brought in to help clean up the streets, basically to move away heavy rubble and apparently to help people that were trapped on higher floors.
That would be amazing. I mean, on the one hand, I've been bombed out, but on the other hand, free elephant ride.
Yeah.
It's not all bad news.
Did I hit your elephant fact?
You did not. I shall have to bring my elephant fact to the verdict.
Is that because you've forgotten it?
No.
Oh, tease.
I'm luring people to the verdict.
You big tease. Well, if you're going to tease, then I shall do the same. Let's talk about the history of London, Pete, after this.
Hey, nice.
Hey, Pete.
Hey, Ryan, what are you wearing?
It's me old Pearly King whistle, ain't it?
What?
My whistle and flute suit. I'm a right blooming cockney, I am.
Oh, right, you're a cockney now, are you?
That's right, me old china. Cockney this and cockney that. It's all I rabbit on about.
What?
Rabbit and pork. Talk.
Right, gotcha. And just out of interest, where were you born?
Just down the old Frog and Toad.
Right, so down the road.
Born and raised, ever since I was a dustbin lid.
Ryan, you cannot be a cockney. To be a cockney, you have to be born within the sound of Bow Bells, which is in East London, and that's miles away.
Really? You're not telling me a porky pie, are you?
Really, I am not.
Oh, well, thank God for that, because being a cockney is exhausting, Pete. Nobody understands anything you say.
Good. You know, Ryan, you should just be happy being yourself.
What? Oh, God, no, no. I'm going to be a New Yorker.
What?
How you doing? Get me a coffee and a bagel on Rye at the corner of 5th and 9th.
Ryan, you're an idiot.
Get out of here, you schmuck. All right, Pete. Well, look, I think everybody is fully oriented now on where the world-famous London is. But what people might not know is the history of London. Strikes me like there might be a lot of it. So why don't you walk us through it, Pete?
Let's get on it at a fair clip, because as you rightly point out, there is an awful lot of it. So I'm going to get us started on the tricky note about this episode, Ryan, which is during our time period, London was not really a thing. It certainly wasn't a place with that name. So our time period, there was no London, actually. But having said that, the remains of what maybe various ancient structures suggest human habitation for a long, long time, even though it wasn't necessarily a particularly large centre of population. So if you go to Vauxhall in South London, which you will know perhaps better as the location of the head office of MI6, that is to say the home office of James Bond.
Heck yes.
If you go down to the shore there, at low tide, archaeologists found a line of timbers parallel to the shore, and they carbon dated those to around 4,500 BCE, the late Mesolithic period or the late Middle Stone Age.
Wow.
So good news, Ryan. There were some people. Hurrah.
Didn't really help with my research, though.
No, I understand that. I had similar
problems. Made things a lot harder.
No one quite knows what these row of stakes represented or what they were, but they were certainly man-made and some sort of structure. But also in Vauxhall, about 600 metres south of these little poles, is what may have been London's oldest known bridge, or at least, again, the remains of it. So this one is 3,500 years ago, about 1,500 BCE, and it's the wooden remains of a 3-metre-wide structure that was noticed in 1993 when erosion had brought the topsoil down enough to see these supporting poles. So they figured out it was a bridge. In 2002, the archaeology TV show Time Team, which I know you're a fan of, Ryan.
Massive fan.
They concluded that the structure was probably a bridge to a gravel island in the middle of the river. It may also have been a jetty, because it's kind of a small protruding into the river structure, but nevertheless, it was something of that nature.
I was going to say, because the Thames today is essentially throttled through like the main city area, whereas previously it was a lot wider.
Yes, a lot wider, but crucially a lot shallower. So when you think of a bridge over the Thames, especially in that area, now it has to be pretty big and go bank to bank. But actually, this was a kind of marshy, shallow area with perhaps gravel islands in the middle as well. So Actually, the reason that the oldest and then this old bridge were in almost exactly the same place was this was likely the first fordable part of the river, in fact. So that's where people kind of gravitated to, because it was the first place where you could actually get across.
That makes a lot of sense.
A lot of sense. So Time Team actually made a recreation of this bridge, and I'll put a picture of it on our social media if you guys want to check that out. That's at HHE Podcast. Sadly, though, Ryan, a bridge does not a city make, as we know. So there was an archaeologist called Leslie Wallace who said, because no late pre-Roman Iron Age settlements, that is to say our period, or significant domestic refuge have been found in London, despite archaeological excavation extensively, arguments for a purely Roman foundation of London are now common and uncontroversial. That is to say, it was the Romans what got it started.
Again, not very helpful for our research.
Not at all. Nevertheless, let's cut to 43 CE and the arrival of a large number of Italian tourists with swords.
Hooray!
Hurrah! It's the Roman invasion under Emperor Claudius.
Those Romans are crazy.
They are. Now, Claudius needed a new capital, so what did he go for? Camulodunum, Dunum, modern-day Colchester, which, Ryan, you may be familiar with.
Yeah, I grew up in Colchester. Camulodunum, the oldest recorded town.
Did you feel cheated that you weren't the modern capital of the UK?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Also, so Norwich had the capital title for a while as well, so I think everyone just gets a go at it.
I think York gets a go as well in Viking times as well. So, fair enough, everyone has their turn. Eventually it'll come round to Croydon. But anyway, the Colchester does not last as a capital, and a new settlement is developed along the River Thames, where the City of London is today. You mentioned the City of London being a square mile, a very tiny area of London. So this was, essentially in Roman terms, a new town. It was like established by the Romans. It wasn't just taking over an existing settlement. And it was called Londinium. And this was believed to have been formed somewhere around 47 CE.
Very good. Did it have an underground?
It did not have an underground. It was entirely overground.
That makes sense, because it's only 1 mile square, right? You could probably just walk that.
That's true. Oh, you could do an underground, but it would just be a very short tunnel that you walk through instead of walking along the ground. Perhaps not so useful. But this lasted 13 years. And then Boudica, who we mentioned, arrived, the queen of the Iceni, and destroyed it.
Yeah, I've never really thought about it. When I've heard of Boudica turning up and, you know, razing London to the ground, actually, if it's only a mile square, that's not as big as I thought it was, actually. In my head, London's huge. So she's like, burnt London to the ground. But actually, that wasn't such a bad thing.
Relatively. It was pretty shocking if you lived there, though, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Nevertheless, after Boudica burnt the place down, the Romans came back and rebuilt the place, basically. They built a bridge near the site of the present-day London Bridge, and it had walls, not unsurprisingly, to protect the place, learning from their experience with the dodgy Iceni folks. So, 410 CE, with a bit of trouble back home, the Romans give up on their British holiday and they leave the island and the City of London behind.
With a mug with "Mind the Gap" written on it.
So after this, and this is weird to me, but I guess because it was kind of a new build, the city kind of fell into disrepair. The Anglo-Saxons did move into the area, but it was kind of later and kind of down the road. They didn't just move in and occupy that area. It just kind of stopped for a while until the early 7th century, when a place called Ludenwick, which is about a mile west of Londinium, around Covent Garden today, was set up by the Anglo-Saxons. And that was the kind of return of a form of London.
It's interesting.
Yeah, later on, it was Alfred the Great, who you may have heard of, who renewed the old city walls in the late 800s, and they brought the old Roman area back into use.
Okay.
And then the Danish king Canute, he invaded and he took over England from 1016, and his stepson, Edward the Confessor, became king in 1042. I bring Edward the Confessor into this because he needed somewhere to do his confessing, and he built Westminster Abbey.
Really? That's that old? Okay.
Shortly after that comes Norman. Well, the Normans. William the Conqueror, also known as William the Bastard, and the invasion of 1066. So the Normans become the medievals, peasants revolt, the Black Death kills half the city, and the city grows. It becomes a twisting mass of streets and alleys with close-packed buildings made of timber and straw.
That sounds perfect.
Well, we may come back to that.
Health and safety be damned.
So now we roll into the Tudors. Henry VIII dissolves the monasteries and a lot of land in London changes hands. So a lot of old monasteries then become people's houses. London takes off as a port and a trade centre, and the wealth brings entertainment, including theatres showing the work of a promising young playwright called William something or other.
I don't know. Never heard of it.
Never. Won't catch on.
Much ado about nothing.
Hey! Moving on to the Stuarts, starting with Jimmy Stuart, the young King James I of England taking the throne. He's followed sometime after by Charles I, who rather foolishly starts a civil war in which the King fights with Parliament and the City of London is on the side of Parliament, which wins and the King loses his head, quite literally. Another bout of plague hits the city in 1665, but don't worry, we'll clear it up in 1666 by burning the city to the ground in the Great Fire of London.
Buddha see us back!
No, this was a self-inflicted fire, starting in a bakery in Pudding Lane.
Isn't that where Monument is?
No, Monument is the height of Monument away from Pudding Lane. If you push the Monument over, it would land with its top in Pudding Lane.
Why'd they do that? When they just put it where it was?
It was all smoky, I would imagine.
Yeah, probably.
The fire actually destroyed 60% of the city.
Okay, that's a lot.
Yeah, but on the plus side, a gentleman named Christopher Wren was commissioned to rebuild bits of it, including a little-known church known as St. Paul's Cathedral.
People hated that, didn't they, when it first opened?
The cathedral?
Yeah, they turned up and threw stones through the windows.
Oh, really? Oh, it was ever thus, eh? Yeah. That's modernist monstrosity.
Yeah, he said that he wasn't going to build it with a dome, and then he just hid it and built it with
Ta-da!
A dome.
What dome? Could have gaslighted the whole of London. I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. Okay, we're into the 18th century Iran. We're galloping along. More growth, industrialisation, new neighbourhoods, Mayfair, fancy places.
Gosh, this really is a whirlwind tour of the history of London. There's a lot that's happened, isn't it?
There's a lot going on. We're clattering into the 19th century. The British Empire helps London become the world's largest city. 1 million people in 1800, grows to 6.7 million at the end of that century.
I mean, what? There's 9 million now.
Yeah, exactly. It was massive. The world's biggest city, and all of their waste is pouring straight into the Thames.
Of course. So it makes total sense. Yeah. Also, where you get your drinking water from.
Well, yes. And in unrelated news, in 1858, they had what was known as the Great Stink. Now, for obvious reasons, an engineer called Joseph Bazalgette was commissioned to build sewers for the place, resulting in 2,100 kilometres of tunnels and pipes under London that we still use today.
That seems like a complicated job.
Yeah, it was a hefty job. And I believe he kind of doubled the size of everything with one eye to the future. So we owe him a debt of gratitude.
Absolutely.
Other features of the town: urchins picking a pocket or two and singing whilst they did it, as chronicled by one Mr. Charlie Dickens.
Yes, of course.
OK, we're going strong now. We're nearly there, Ryan. We're into the 20th century. Population grows despite the Depression and the First World War. Then the Second World War, a big bombing campaign during the Blitz reshaped large chunks of the city and killed 30,000 Londoners. But we win. And as a reward, we get to enjoy swinging London in the 1960s, Carnaby Street, the King's Road and all of that good stuff.
Austin Powers.
Exactly. Post-war, Ryan, the Docklands area, which handled all the shipping, declined because it couldn't cope with the bigger modern container ships, but this area in the 1980s was revived with large offices being built in the area, including Canary Wharf, which first opened in 1991.
I remember seeing that being built.
Then we're into the millennium. The nation celebrates by disappointing millions of people with a baffling exhibition at the newly built Millennium Dome.
I remember seeing that being built.
But it was also the time of the opening of what I think is the most iconic contribution to the London skyline in my lifetime, the London Eye.
I remember seeing that being built.
Now, in 2012, Ryan, we hosted the Olympics, and for a brief period, everyone felt good about themselves. And then in 2023, London was the location for the coronation of King Charles. Huzzah! And who knows what the future holds? Maybe after 2024, in a not-so-glamorous corner of London known as Croydon, the next big podcast sensation will emerge.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, Ryan, that's the history of London and its monuments in a whistle-stop tour.
I love that. That was genuinely, that was amazing. Thank you so much, Pete. I really enjoyed that. That was great.
Thank you.
Hitler!
Heil me.
Mein Führer, I have the invasion plans and we can occupy London within the week.
Excellent, Herr General. First we enjoyed the artisanal chocolates of Brussels. Then we sampled the fine vines and cordon bleu cooking of Paris. Now we shall enjoy. Remind me, General, what food do they eat in London?
Well, according to our intelligence, Mein Führer, they eat jellied eels.
I'm sorry, what?
Eels in a gelatinous gloop.
The eels?
Ja, Mein Führer! Eels! Jellied eels! They boil them and set them into the jelly and eat them cold!
As a dessert?
Nein, Mein Führer! A snacken sie!
Right! Jellied eels, eh? And out of interest, what else do they have?
Well, the report says some sort of basic meat pie with crushed kartoffel and thin green sauce.
Ah, right, but they have the spices to spruce up these dishes, yeah?
Nein, Mein Führer! Not a single spice!
Right.
Yeah. So, how about we just stay here in Berlin with the fine wines and chocolates and blitz London with the bombs until there is nothing left?
Excellent idea, mein General. Now, what is for dinner?
Well, I believe the chef has prepared your favorite dish, mein Führer. Rendered meat stuffed inside of the intestines with a side of cabbage, nicely fermented.
Delicious.
Hey, Hitler.
Hail me.
So, Ryan, how big is an elephant?
Yeah, it's a good question, isn't it? The topic of this episode seems relatively straightforward. Find things which are bigger than an elephant. But the problem, Pete, is that that's not very specific, is it?
It is not.
So, before we get into our stories, I thought it best to try and define what measurement we're referring to when saying that something is bigger than an elephant. So, using my renowned knowledge of science and mathematics...
Oh, good God.
I thought I would work it out with utmost precision.
Oh.
So let's start with the basics. What type of elephant are we going to use as our standard? Because depending on where you're located in the world, your view of what an elephant looks like might change. For example, if I asked you to picture an elephant in your mind, You, as somebody who lives in the West, might think of Loxodonta africana, the African savanna elephant, the largest of the elephant subspecies.
I wouldn't, but that's because I'm circus folk.
Ah, I see. You are a clown, that is true. But, Pete, if you were to live in Asia, picturing an elephant might make you think of Elephas maximus, the Asian elephant, which is the smallest of the elephant species, despite being called Maximus. So how are we going to pick from these two elephants? One which is big, one which is small. Well, I thought we could look to see which has the highest population. And as of this year, population-wise, there are approximately 415,000 savanna elephants across Africa, and only 50,000 Asian elephants in the wild.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so way more African elephants in the world. But is that enough of a measure to determine what elephant to pick? No. Because, after all, we're trying to determine which of the subspecies is most commonly associated with the term elephant. Just because there's loads of them doesn't mean they're most commonly associated with the term elephant. And that means not just looking at population numbers, Pete, but also those which are most commonly visible to humans. That means factoring in things like proximity to humans, availability in zoos, and presence in media.
I have a picture of you against a wall with pictures and cutouts and thread and elephants and you... wide-eyed, pointing at the threads, going, see, it's all connected.
But we need to look at representation in the media, which, frankly, is a bit of a tie, because while African elephants dominate mainstream Western media, they feature in movies and documentaries and commercials, Asian elephants do pretty much the same in media across Asia. So that's a draw. But if we do a quick Google search for the world's most famous elephant, all the top results reveal that Jumbo the Great African Elephant was the most famous elephant to ever live. And that brings me to another factor, cultural significance. Because while African elephants are considered culturally significant in their native countries, internationally, they're mostly viewed through the lens of conservation and wildlife protection. Whereas, Pete, in many parts of Asia, especially India, the Asian elephant holds a significant cultural and religious role. They often appear in various religious iconography, annual festivals, processions. In fact, in some places, they actually form part of the workforce, helping to deforest wooded areas for, you know, new housing development or roads or whatever. So, I think a win for the Asian elephant.
So what's the score in aggregate so far?
The subspecies that conjures the word elephant in the minds of the general public is, well, I think it's a draw. So I think what we're going to do is we're just going to combine both the subspecies into our size equations, which means that if the average height of an adult African elephant stands at around 3 meters at the shoulder and an average adult Asian elephant stands at around 2.5 meters, then the combined average height of a hypothetical general elephant would be 2.75 meters. That's 9 feet tall. Easy.
Wow, you really took the scenic route to get there, didn't you?
So with that in mind, let's start with our first thing, which is bigger than an elephant, in London during 509 to 27 BCE, after this.
There's something wrong with you, Ryan.
I am not a lunatic. This all makes sense. Good night, darling. Is something wrong?
No.
Well, look, clearly something is wrong.
No.
Right.
My God, you really haven't remembered, have you?
Remembered? Remembered what?
Oh, this is so typical. Do I mean nothing to you?
What are you talking about?
It was our anniversary today.
What? Oh, of course I remembered that.
Oh, really? Well, the fact that you've not said anything once says otherwise. No card, no present, not even a kiss.
But no,
Even bother trying to find an excuse.
Look, I'm sorry, but I have had a busy day at the zoo.
Oh, not this again.
It's Saturday. There's loads of visitors on a Saturday.
I don't care. You always do this.
Oh, come on. Name one other time.
Okay, September the 1st, 2004, my 30th birthday.
What? Yes, but okay, right.
April 19th, 2007, our anniversary.
April
19th, 2012, our anniversary again. July 15th, 2015, my sister's birthday. September 2nd, 2016, 3rd of March, 2017.
All right.
And every time it's, I'm sorry, darling, I forgot to get you anything. I promise I won't do it again.
Oh, come on. This isn't fair. Of course you remember everything. You're an elephant.
So are you.
Well, yes, but, you know, actually, I heard the zoo keeper say the other day that elephants never forgetting is actually an offensive stereotype perpetuated by the media.
So what?
So, you know, anyway, as it happens, I actually did remember.
Did you?
Yes, and here's your gift. These peanuts.
Peanuts?
Yeah. Happy anniversary, love.
You are the best elephant ever. I love peanuts.
I know, I remembered.
Oh, darling.
Happy anniversary, love.
Happy anniversary.
All right, Ryan, so we're going to find something bigger than an elephant, 2.5 metres, 2.75 metres tall, in London, which didn't exist at the time, during the Roman Republic. Correct?
Correct.
Well, then come with me to northeast London. Before you hit the M25, you will come to a place called Lawton.
Lawton.
Lawton. Lawton is right by Epping Forest. Specifically, it's 2,400 hectares or 5,900 acres of ancient woodland. Ancient woodland has a specific definition. It's having existed continuously since 1600.
Oh, okay.
Now, in Epping Forest, Ryan, if you walk around for long enough, you might come across Lawton Camp.
Okay.
I'll be honest, you might well come across it without even realising. It's very, very easy to miss because in its current form, it is essentially a bank and a ditch.
Right. I would miss that.
You would miss it. I've looked at pictures of it and I will post pictures of it on the social media because you look at it and go, yeah, but where is it?
Okay.
But the bank actually represents, when you kind of pull up and look at it from above, the protective earthworks of an Iron Age camp, which makes sense because this camp is situated at the highest point in the area around.
Okay, yeah, that does make sense.
So the earthworks encompasses an area of about 4 hectares or 10 acres or about 6 football pitches, which if you spread your elephant out, I'm pretty sure is still bigger than an elephant.
Yeah.
But fortunately for me, it has an outer ditch which was dug out to about 3 metres high.
Nice.
Higher than an elephant. Now, this camp was estimated to have been in use around about 500 BCE and through that time period. But at that time, you wouldn't have had a forest there. It would have been cleared of trees by the people. So you'd have had a protective earthworks and a slope, and you're on a high point and you can see out. You're not just hidden in the woods as the site is today.
Yeah, that would just be a tree fort, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
No girls allowed.
Yeah, yeah, you're in boy gang territory at that point, aren't you? Now, what was it for is probably a question on your lips right now, although I've called it a fort. There's not a lot left there. There's some banks and it's a location more than it is a find.
Okay.
It has the name of a fort, but it isn't actually today believed to have been primarily a military installation, in fact.
Oh, okay.
There are a couple of theories. One is it was a lookout post because it's obviously in a high area. Another is it was just a place to take refuge and particularly to take your cattle if you were under attack.
Yep.
And the reason they think of this is this fort was located at the boundary between two warring tribes, the Trinovantes, which was the people who were siding with the Romans, so the client kingdom, and their neighbours were called the Catavellauni, and they were the guys who fought against the Romans when the Romans arrived.
Again, they'll get mentioned later too.
Ah, good. So there's a ditch and then a high bank. So you sort of dig out your ditch and then use the earth to create a bank. Then at the top of the bank, you would have put a fence, essentially a palisade, round the top of your bank, giving you a kind of formidable defensive structure. Now, nothing was really found here, but one thing was found in the area, which was a quern stone. And this was a kind of milling tool that was in use at that time. This is part of the reason they didn't think it was necessarily a military camp. It's kind of an everyday item.
Hmm.
So, Ryan, the fort, in all honesty, is not particularly impressive, but it did make me wonder, how did you dig these big 3 meter tall, is not insubstantial earthworks, given that they didn't really have mechanical diggers or much in the way of machinery
or elephants,
any machinery or elephants.
Yeah.
So according to some archaeologists, and this is based on finds at a bunch of different Iron Age sites, the answer is antlers and bones.
Oh, okay.
So the dynamic duo we're looking here is the antler pick and the scapular shovel.
Nice. Plenty of those lying around, I imagine, in a forested area.
Well, exactly. The antler pick, you probably have a little guess as to what an antler pick is.
Is it like just an antler that you use like a pick?
Very much just an antler, very much in its antlery form as well, because it's kind of pick-shaped. Okay. If you chop a bit off, you get a kind of handle with a sticky out bit that acts as a pick.
Yeah.
I did read some people who said that actually it wasn't really a pick for whacking, but more of a lever for levering. But in any event, you need something to kind of break up the earth or rock that you're trying to dig through. And antlers are brilliantly handy for your Iron Age man because, yeah, like you say, it's already kind of pick-shaped, so you don't have to do too much in the way of crafting to make it effective for you. It's already got a stem and it's already got sharp pointy bits sticking off.
And presumably you're killing them to eat them all the time, so you've got a ready supply.
Well, you don't need to because the antlers literally fall off the red deer once a year. So all you've got to do is walk around and pick them up.
Huh. You just have a little antler collection day.
Exactly. You go walking around where you know red deer are prone to hanging out, and bingo, handy tool.
That's amazing.
But once you've broken up all the soil, you're going to want to get rid of it somehow. Probably you've got a basket of woven wickery type basket of some kind, but you've got to get the stuff into your basket. Enter the scapular shovel, the unsung hero of Iron Age building work.
Yeah, you'd think that they would be using iron during this iron age of theirs.
Well, they may well have had iron also, but it's pretty precious stuff, so just using it for something as ordinary as digging is perhaps not the idea. You want to save it for your weaponry, maybe.
It wasn't the scapular age.
For a very long time, it may have been the scapular age, because the scapula is, you probably know, the shoulder blade, particularly of a large mammal for this purpose, like an ox or a cow or a horse.
Or an elephant.
Or an elephant. Now, well, it's funny you should say that. We'll come back to that. But oxen don't shed their bones in quite the same way as deer shed their antlers. But, you know,
yeah.
Once you've got a dead oxen, it's easy enough to pull a scapula out of it.
Man, imagine if we all shed bones. That'd be so weird.
Well, we do it with teeth when we're young, don't we?
All right. Yep.
So anyway, the question that this led me to is, well, that's all very well, you say this is how it works, but how do you know it works? And this brings us to experimental archaeology.
Okay.
So this is an area of archaeology that had never really occurred to me was a thing, but basically it's all very well speculating on, look, we found some antlers, therefore probably it was used as a pick. But experimental archaeology goes further and they go, well, put it to the test. Let's just try and do it and see if it works. So this was just one of the things that was conducted in a really interesting experiment called the Overton Down Experimental Earthworks.
Okay.
So in this, they dug out an earthworks, quite similar to what we see in Lawton Camp, a ditch and a bank. And they had a bunch of things they were trying to do. One of it was they were trying to experiment to bury cloths and materials into the earth to see how they break down. It's called taphonomy, this is. It's the study of how organisms decay and become fossilized or preserved. So the idea is, once you've buried a bit of leather and seen it after 50 years, you kind of know the progress of this decomposition, so that when you've got old stuff, you can track back to imagine how it got there.
Okay, yeah.
So they constructed the earthworks using Iron Age equipment. They used scapular shovels and they used antler picks. So yeah, they dug out the earthworks and they used baskets, antler picks and scapular shovels. The scapular shovels, I guess they didn't seem to work so well. It was more of a scraper than a shoveler when they did it. But between the two tools, they concluded that actually this stuff worked pretty good. Their calculations were that a worker with modern hand tools could move about 3.58 cubic feet of earth per man hour.
Okay.
So you, on your own, in an hour, will move 3.8 cubic feet of earth.
Was that like a big suitcase?
Yeah, let's say a big suitcase.
Okay.
That was with modern hand tools. With primitive tools, they figured they could move 3 cubic feet of earth per man hour. So not much less at all. They actually thought, yeah, this stuff works pretty good. They figured a small burial mound or barrow could be made by 10 people in a week.
So why aren't we giving our, like, modern construction workers scapulas and antlers?
Well, that extra 0.58 cubic feet an hour probably makes all the difference, doesn't it? But I did mention that the scapular shovel was less satisfactory than the antler pick, but you'll be delighted to learn that study is ongoing. There are archaeologists such as Charlie Mansfield still conducting experiments, like attaching handles of different lengths and trying to figure out how you might use a shoulder blade as a shovel, which, come the apocalypse, we will be very grateful for, I'm sure.
That's a fun form of archaeology.
Well, it really is, and I tell you what, it's really long-sighted as well, because the Overton Down experiment was started in 1960,
mm-hmm.
and they have review points at 2 years, 4 years, 8, 16, 32, 64, and possibly 128 years.
Wow, that's cool.
So they started in 1960. In 1992, there was a paper to assess the results from the first 32 years of the project, and they concluded it's still a little too soon to judge whether the experimental earthworks project is worthwhile.
Right. So when do we check in?
Well, it should have happened a few years ago. I didn't find anything, but we'll have a look and see what's going on with that.
Absolutely. I want to know what's going on.
I bet you do. So Ryan, get out there, grab yourself an antler and a spare shoulder blade, and we too could make our own Iron Age style hill fort that's bigger than an elephant in just a few dozen backbreaking days of labour.
Hooray. That was great. Nice one, Pete.
Thank you.
You okay, sir? Can I help you find anything?
Oh, hi. Actually, yes. I'm going to be doing some trench work, and I'm just a little bit lost about what type of tool I should use.
Trench work, eh? Right, I see. Well, tricky stuff. This your first trench?
Yeah, it is.
And it's for the home?
No, it's a fort, actually.
Right, well, you're going to be moving a lot of earth, so you're going to need a scapular shovel, I reckon.
Oh, right, okay.
This one's top of the range, sir. Removed from the oxen while it was still warm.
Very nice.
If you're on a budget, though, you could use a humerus hoe. The leg bone isn't quite as efficient as a scapula, but it'll get the job done.
Okay.
And I have seen some trenches dug with a femur fork and a tibia trowel, but it will take more effort.
Okay, well, do you know what? I think I'll just take the scapula, actually.
Great. Anything else I can help with?
Yes, I need a box of 4-inch finger nails and a mandible mallet. Oh, also I'll need a tube of sputum glue.
No problem. Our saliva is famously sticky, sir.
And I've got some bolts already, so I'm just going to need a couple of nuts.
Righto, and what size, sir? Rabbit, goat or oxen?
Oh, oxen, please.
Righto, a couple of nuts coming right up.
So Ryan, I found something bigger than an elephant in the Iron Age. Did you?
Yes. So our time period, 509 to 27 BCE. That covers a period of British history prior to the Roman occupation. But there was still a Roman influence on Britain during that time. In fact, long before any legionary stepped foot on the island. In fact, for a long time, Pete, tribal chiefs of Britain were trading with the Roman Empire. They were exchanging metals and grains and animal hides and possibly antlers and scapulas.
Maybe scapulas. Got a nice shovel for you.
In exchange for Roman luxuries like wine and figs and exotic glass ornaments.
I'd imagine in a quiz show in the old days, that's what would have been the prize. The glass ornament!
Hooray! But in the middle of the first century, before the Common Era, Gaius Julius Caesar arrived in Gaul. That's modern-day France. And he started rampaging around, claiming lands for the Roman Empire.
He did love a rampage.
He did indeed. Now, Caesar was in something of a political popularity contest with a couple of rivals in Rome, people called Crassus and Pompey. And he realised that he needed to do something bold and extraordinary to beat them in the race for political power. So, Caesar decided to do what no Roman had done before, and that was to cross the English Channel into Britain, a mysterious and dangerous land that was considered by many to be at the very edge of the world. So, giving himself permission to attack Britain by claiming that they needed to be punished for supporting his enemies in Gaul, he started to prepare his troops. And at midnight on August 23rd in the year 55 BCE, Caesar leads two Roman legions with 500 cavalry out into the channel towards Britain. On ships. They weren't swimming. This was a bad idea. Now, as it turns out, it was a bit of a bad idea because they immediately entered a storm, which resulted in 18 of Caesar's ships having to return back to Gaul. Undeterred, however, by 9 o'clock the next morning, Caesar and his fleet arrive at the White Cliffs of Dover, Pete.
Right, sorry, 9 a.m. Has he got a watch? How's this going on?
Yeah, apparently it was 9 o'clock in the morning.
All right.
He was recording this as he was going, so yeah. Now, not only did they have the inability to actually get off their boats because of the huge vertical wall in front of them, but also at the top of the cliff was a whole long line of British warriors with painted faces, angrily staring down at them, saying, "Oi, get out of here, you."
Girl, come on in if you think you're hard enough.
Exactly. Yeah, so unable to land in Dover, Caesar orders his fleet to follow the coast round to the east. And eventually, they find a suitable landing bay. And as they pull their ships in, they find themselves staring at those British warriors again, who had followed the ships along the coastline all the way from Dover.
Yep, you're right, guys. Yep.
Yeah. So the Romans ready themselves for a fight, but quickly they realise that their transport ships are unable to get close enough to the shoreline, which means that the only way that Caesar can get his legionnaires to the shore was by them jumping directly into the water while wearing their heavy armour.
Ooh, that doesn't sound like a fun time.
Now, according to Caesar's own account, no one wanted to do that.
I didn't think you would need to record that necessarily. I would have assumed something of that nature.
Until one kiss-ass standard bearer from the 10th Legion shouts, "Leap, fellow soldiers! Unless you wish to betray your eagle to the enemy, I, for my part, will perform my duty to the Republic and to my general before leaping into the sea."
Ah, I can only imagine the ripple that went around the ship going, "Oh, for fuck that."
Apparently, this then inspired his fellow soldiers, who, one by one, all jumped into the water.
Oh, my lord.
Yeah. Now, this wasn't a great idea, Pete, because now you're not only struggling to get to shore in the cold water, but the Britons then started to just fire a hail of rocks, arrows, and javelins at them.
Yeah, I mean, this is the opening of Saving Private Ryan, only with rocks.
Now, despite this attack, eventually the Roman soldiers actually reach shallow water and they manage to form a rather waterlogged battle line, which the British were then happy to attack. So watching this skirmish from his ship, Caesar deploys more men into the battle and he provides support by pelting everyone on the beach with rocks fired from catapults mounted on the deck of his ships, which begs the question why he didn't do that before.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Military genius.
Now, remarkably, all of this seems to work in his favour, because soon the Britons become overwhelmed and they scatter off into the surrounding forests, leaving a bunch of the soaking wet Romans to sort of fist bump and high five. Yeah, and relish their first victory on British soil. Now, they make camp and night passes, and the next morning, ambassadors from the local tribes arrive at the Roman camp and claim to have no knowledge of these warriors from the day before. Don't know what you're talking about.
I don't know, that wasn't us, it must have been one of the other tribes. Oh, yeah, those guys, terrible, yeah. Terrible.
In unrelated news, we'd like to offer our support to you. So, not a bad start for Caesar, just 2 days into a British invasion, and he's going very well. But things go downhill fast after that, because another storm destroys the ships that are anchored off the beach. And worse, Roman reinforcements, which Caesar was expecting, are unable to cross the channel from Gaul either. So he's now just stranded. So, having already bent their knee to these new Roman overlords, the Britons seize on this opportunity to do a bit of a takesy-backsies and form a large coalition and attack Caesar's men. But again, despite the odds, the Romans are able to push the British horde away. But recognising that the odds were not going to be in his favour going forward, Caesar orders some urgent makeshift repairs on the ships, then leads a hasty retreat back to Gaul.
Anyway, I won. Bye.
See ya. Now there, he arrives back in Gaul and he immediately starts planning a second invasion. And it doesn't take long, because 1 year later in 54 BCE, his invasion force, which is now double the size of the original, with an armada of 600 ships carrying 25,000 soldiers, and a force of local warriors led by Gaulish chieftains, cast off on the night of July the 6th and arrive in Britain the following morning, 8:36 a.m. I don't know what time. Now, this time, Caesar's prepared, but the beaches are empty. Britons aren't there, and so he just takes the opportunity to march his forces inland until they meet a large British force which was waiting for them in the woods. So, a battle ensues, but guess what? The Romans win. And the very next morning, Caesar receives word that another storm has damaged the ships that he anchored offshore.
Oh, this place, man. He must be like, I hate this place. The weather is terrible.
Yeah, something which many visitors to these isles have said since. So reluctantly, he returns to the beach and he orders that all the boats be repaired, because I think he learned his lesson from last time. Best to have an escape plan.
Leave the back door open.
Now, unfortunately, this distraction allows some of the larger tribes of Britain to put aside their differences and again unite against this common enemy. And leading their coalition was their mightiest chieftain, a man named Castelvenius.
Castelvenius?
Yes, a barbarian brute whose strategic mind was said to rival that of Caesar's own.
Ooh.
Now, quickly gathering an army of his own, Castelvenius heads south to meet Caesar. And Caesar, having now fixed his ships, assembles his own men and marches towards the River Thames, a journey which was interrupted by Castelvenius's 4,000 chariots, which attacked Caesar's Roman column using hit-and-run tactics, basically swerving in close and hurling javelins at the Romans before quickly disappearing off into the surrounding forest.
That's how I'd like to fight. Run up, chuck something, run off again.
Run away! And the benefit of that is that Caesar sent his cavalry after the chariots, which were then lured into ambushes in the forest and were all slaughtered. So again, things not looking great for Caesar. But in this moment of weakness, he suddenly receives an unexpected bit of good news in the form of a messenger from a local tribe called the Trinovantes.
Aha!
Which, by the way, Pete, I don't know if you found this out, but that means the very vigorous people.
No, I did not. That's news.
Yeah. Anyway, so this messenger tells Caesar that not every tribe in Britain stands with Castelvenius. In fact, the Trinovantes were especially unhappy with Castelvenius because in the past few years before Caesar had got there, he had led a particularly bloody and brutal campaign against them. Now, the Trinovantes were an important tribe because they owned the territory to the east of England. It was a fertile land that ran from Suffolk through Essex all the way south to Trinovantum, which was an area north of the River Thames that would later become known as Caer Lud, then Lundane, Londinium, and finally London, as we know it today. Anyway, the point being that their territory was full of land and had access to the River Thames, which was a vital artery for trade throughout Britain and abroad. Now, this made the Trinovantes one of the most powerful tribes in Britain, and Castlevenius wanted control of all of that land for himself. So with his army, he had attacked the Trinovantes, raided their lands, laid siege on their hilltop fort, killed their king, Immanuentis, and caused the king's son, Prince Mandubracius, to flee for his life. Now, Mandubracius' escape came with the help of some of his father's loyalists. Under the Shroud of Night, they helped him slip out from the besieged settlement and they headed south, over a 100-mile trip to the River Thames, where they stuck to the edge of the riverbank in an effort to sort of avoid the pathways that were patrolled by Castlevenius' men. The river was their escape route. It offered a winding path through the landscape to the south coast, where they could then sail across the channel to Gaul, where they hoped that they could hide out there. But to successfully make that journey, they needed a boat. And it needed to be a boat sturdy enough to handle not just the waters of the Thames, but also the 30-mile journey across the channel. It needed to be a small vessel to avoid being seen, but also large enough to carry the prince, his companions, and all of their provisions. Things like dried meat, grains, herbs, fruits, water, gold, silver, jewellery, and weaponry. All the things that they were going to need when they got to Gaul. So, Pete, they set to work, cutting down huge 20-metre-tall oak trees and using that wood to build a boat that was about 12 feet in length, with a mast that stood just as high.
I'm struggling to imagine this. How is that relative to, say, an elephant?
Well, bigger than an elephant.
Okay, right. That's really helpful. Thank you.
No worries. Now, despite the dangers, their escape in the boat is a success because once Mandubracius and his men reach Gaul, they meet with local Gallic tribes who take them to Roman officials as political refugees. And there, the Romans find them a valuable asset. They have knowledge of the lands to the north. And so Mandubracius finds himself in the company of a Roman leader named Gaius Julius Caesar.
Ooh, he's the big man.
Now, impressed with this young prince, Caesar takes him under his wing and unofficially adopts him as something of a surrogate son.
Nice, that's turned out well for Mandubracius.
Which is why, later, as Caesar is now in Britain struggling against Castlevanius, he is extremely pleased to be approached by this representative of the Trinovantes, who by sheer coincidence was just going to ask for his help in returning Prince Mandubracius to them.
I may know a Mandubracius.
Now, considering this a fortunate and simple request, Caesar just hands over Mandubracius.
He's over there.
And standing by their word, the Trinovantes get five other tribes with their own grievances against Castlevenius to join Caesar's side. And together, they attack Castlevenius' hilltop fort, they cause him to surrender and agree to pay tribute to Rome, promising not to seek revenge against the Trinovantes, which are now under Roman protection, thanks to Mandubracius and Caesar's affection for each other.
I love that. I love the idea that the Trinovantes have come and gone, we will help you, but you must do this challenging thing for us. Find Mandubracius. Oh, he's there. Hi, Mandubracius. Right. Yeah, I guess we're on your side now. Okay.
Could you have just pretended? Give us an hour.
More. Why didn't we ask for gold or something? I didn't know it was going to be that easy.
Ask for exotic glass ornaments.
We could have had beads.
So anyway, all done and dusted now. Caesar gets his Romans to just pack up their belongings and head back to Gaul.
All right, bye. I won again.
So ultimately, his invasion didn't like establish a permanent Roman presence. That would come, you know, about 90 years later. But it did set the precedence of chieftains in Britain now living under a Roman influence. And all because of a prince that escaped London in a boat that was bigger than an elephant.
Well done, Ryan. That was an excellent story and brilliantly elephant related.
I'm glad you liked it.
I did. That was excellent.
I didn't read any of that from a script. I have the memory of an elephant.
Are you afraid of mice as well?
Mice? What?
How do elephants hide in cherry trees?
I don't know. How do elephants hide in cherry trees?
Paint their balls red.
Yeah.
What's the loudest noise in the jungle?
Don't know.
A giraffe eating cherries. Elephant jokes. Mandubracius?
Yes?
You know how we're going to escape by sailing down the River Thames?
Yeah.
And you said we're going to need a big boat.
Yeah.
And I said, well, how big exactly?
Yeah.
And you said, bigger than an olifunk.
Yeah, bigger than an olifunk.
Right, well, the thing is, the guys are not totally agreed on what an olifunk is.
Oh, right.
So John, he thinks he overheard the neighbouring tribe say an olifunk is a large meeting hall for feasts, big enough to accommodate the whole tribe. But Gary, he thinks an olifunk is a kind of giant who slays his enemies with a club made of an entire tree. And Toby, he says it's the golden shell of an enormous snail that wends its way around Britain, leaving presents for children during the solstice.
No, I don't think it's any of those.
Right. So, what is it then?
Well, the merchant, right, who sells exotic glassware to my dad's friend's neighbour, he told me that an olifank is a creature that's 2.75 metres tall, has huge ears, teeth that stick out 3 feet in the air, and has a long nose that reaches down to its knees. So, that.
Really?
Yeah.
Right. And you believed that, did you?
I mean, now that I say it out loud, it does sound a bit silly, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, a little bit, yeah.
So, well, should we just say it's the snail thing, then?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. Bigger than a snail, please.
Righto. Well, Ryan, it was bigger than an elephant. It was in the Roman Republic. It was London. I thought you did a marvellous job. I had a great time. Well done, everyone.
Well done, us. Hope you're listening, Dursley.
Try and ignore that science bit where he went mad at the beginning, if you could.
It makes sense!
But time marches on and the podcast must continue, Ryan. It's time for the audience's eyes to wheel around in their earballs or whatever it is you say normally. And Dursley, the next time, topic and period.
Right, okay. I'm going to switch it on. All right, Peter, here we go. Our place is... Oman.
Oh, man.
Yeah, okay, Oman. All right, and the time is... It is the Great Recession. That's 2007 to 2009.
Wow, I was there and it was not that great.
It was pretty terrible, wasn't it? The terrible recession, we'll call it. Okay, and the topic is... Painting.
Painting, interesting. And decorating, or are we just restricted to painting?
Just painting, I think.
Okay, well, let's see what can be made of that.
Okay then, Pete, for episode 92, we have got painting in Oman.
Yes.
During 2007 to 2009.
Here we go. We'll find something. I'm confident.
All right, let's do it.
Come on, Oman, don't let us down. All right, that's our show for this week. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to get in touch about anything we've talked about today on the show or just to say hi, you can reach us through our website at hhepodcast.com or by email at peteandryan@hhepodcast.com.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you, and you never know, you might end up featured on a future show. And remember, if you're on Mastodon, Instagram, Facebook or X, you can find us at hhepodcast.
And if you subscribe to those, you'll get an alert when we post extra content like pictures of the Iron Age fort and so on.
My whiteboard of madness.
And of course, we'll be back again soon with
The Verdict.
But until then, a huge thanks to you, partner in crime, Ryan.
And a huge thanks to you, partner in crime, Pete.
And that's it. I guess all that's left to say is
you've been listening to
History Happened Everywhere.
Hey, Ryan.
Hey, Pete.
We need to talk about the elephant in the room.
But I don't have anything I'm avoiding talking about.
No, Ryan, the literal elephant that's literally in the actual room right now.
Oh, yeah, that's Marjorie.
Hey, Marjorie. So, why do we have an actual literal elephant, Ryan?
Surprise! She's your birthday gift.
My birthday gift? What am I supposed to do with an actual literal elephant?
Well, she can help you remember important dates.
Ryan, elephants never forgetting is an offensive stereotype perpetuated by the media.
Oh, sorry, Marjorie.
What on earth made you think this was a good idea, Ryan?
Well, remember we were watching that documentary and you said that you loved the elephants?
Yeah.
Well, I thought it'd be a good idea to adopt one for you. So here's Marjorie.
Ryan, that's not what adopting an elephant means.
Really?
Yeah, it's a way of donating money towards protecting their species. You don't get an actual, literal elephant to look after.
Oh, right.
No, no, if you want to adopt an elephant, you go to wwf.org and adopt one there.
wwf.org?
That's right, wwf.org.
Well, I mean, that sounds like something that people should do.
Yes, yes, they should.
Right.
So, I guess now we have an elephant?
I guess so.
Can we return her?
No refunds.
Right. You're an idiot. Not you, Marjorie.
Tell me, what do you love about London?
I love it because I live here.
What do you hate about London?
Too many other people live here.